I shouldn't have left the second bullet on here, but I did want to leave the first one a reminder that homework one is due this Friday. Keep that reminder through homework one, and then after homework one, I'll assume everybody is in the swing of things and knows every Friday there's another homework due. Okay. So last time we went through, we reviewed kind of this maybe a little bit more qualitative or an intuition-based argument of how the buck converter works with this single-pole dual-throw switch that creates a square wave and then a low-pass filter that filters out everything except the DC component. And then we went on to start developing tools that are a bit more general that can allow us to analyze converters even when we don't have this nice separation of our switch stage and then our filter stage. Because the buck converter itself is this unique case where we can do this and kind of intuit the results, but almost all other converters aren't going to behave nicely with these things completely decoupled. So those techniques we developed were first the small ripple approximation, which is fundamentally an approximation. It simplifies the analysis. One thing that if you choose to do so, on this homework, you can look at the extra credit problem, which is if you're looking at, okay, without any of these tools, if you try to do exact time domain analysis of this buck converter, how difficult is it? What goes into that? So it's non-trivial to do. So to make things a little bit more simple, we decouple this, get us down to kind of first order differential equations on most of our passive components. We make this small ripple approximation where we say, for our filter elements, their state can be approximated by just its DC component within one switching period. What that's saying is that we've designed this converter with sufficiently large passives relative to our switching frequency. We've kind of put in the effort and designed this thing so that our switching frequency ripple is small. Okay? So this isn't going to be inherently true of any converter, but we're kind of making an assumption about the result. If I'm going in and designing this converter, I'm going to make sure that I design it so that the output ripple is small. So when I start analyzing it, I can already assume that result is going to be true and use that in my analysis. Okay. So things like capacitor voltages and inductor currents, we're going to apply the small ripple approximation to, say, over one period, we can approximate them as just their average value. Okay. We went through, we began analyzing this buck converter. We did so by splitting it apart into two switching subintervals when the switch was in position one and position two, respectively. And each of these subintervals, we get a linear equivalent circuit, meaning I don't have this nonlinear switching element. I just have inductors, capacitors, resistors, sources, things that we're all very comfortable dealing with. These are still second order, but when I apply small ripple approximation, for example, looking at the inductor behavior, we said this voltage is more or less constant. Then I have something that looks like basically two voltage sources and an inductor. Very easy to analyze. So going through, I apply that in both intervals. I can sketch, for example, the inductor voltage and resulting current. I didn't at the moment yet know kind of where the average value of this current is. I was only able to solve the slopes of both. But then we made this argument that if I want to analyze this thing in steady state and kind of its equilibrium operation, then I know that the current at the beginning of the interval has to be equal to the current at the end of the interval. If that's not true, I'm in some sort of transient condition. My next period is going to be different than this one, and I have to look at those periods independently or develop some kind of other transient analysis, which we'll do later in the course. But for now, we just want to look at nominal steady state operation. And in order to solve that, we look at, okay, now I can apply this extra constraint. If the inductor current at the beginning and the end of the interval is the same thing, I can use that to get an additional equation. We went through and did that at the end of lecture, said, okay, however much my current goes up, it has to come down the same amount for these two currents to be equal and therefore to be in steady state. If I derive expressions for both of those, delta ILs, set them equal to one another, solve through, what I get is an equation that tells me the conversion ratio of the converter. Okay. So this is this volt second balance technique that I promised you. I derive it kind of in this way because I think it's the way that makes sense. Looking at the inductor current at the beginning and end has to be the same. Volt second balance is perhaps not a great name for that. This is more current beginning and end balance. But what we can look at is that this actually reduces down, and we can apply the same analysis a little bit more simply. So here is just a slide from the book talking about where volt second balance comes from. So if I look at the inductor current equation on the top, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to integrate both sides to solve this equation, first order differential equation. So if I integrate both sides with respect to time over one switching period, left side, what I'm going to get is just the integral of the voltage on the inductor over one period. On the right side, I can simplify this. So I can pull the L out of the integral. I'll get L times the integral from 0 to TS of DIL DT DT. When I have this integral with respect to time of the derivative with respect to time, apply chain rule here, change this from a derivative with respect to time to a derivative with respect to current, the integral of DIL. When I do that, I need to change my integral limits to be with respect to current. So now instead of time zero, it'll be IL at time zero. And instead of time TS, it'll be IL at time TS. The integral is just the integral of one with respect to IL. What I'm going to get is IL evaluated within those limits. This becomes L times IL of TS minus IL of zero. This expression is my not quite my two delta IL, but it's my difference between the current at the beginning and end of the interval. And that's what I said, it has to be zero for me to be in steady state. Okay. So with the derivation we did last class on the previous slide, what I did is I solved this thing on the right and set it equal to zero. This volt second balance technique just says, well, it's actually a little bit easier to take the thing on the left, the integral of the voltage on the inductor, since these two are the same, set that equal to zero. After probably this first homework, using the integral of voltage on the inductor, you can almost just look at a circuit and write down the final equation. This one maybe took a little bit more effort, a few more steps in between. Okay. So taking this, here, I've just moved the L over to the other side of the equation, and I'm setting this equal to zero because I'm in steady state. So if that's equal to zero, then the integral of the inductor voltage is equal to zero. And that's really what's derived by this, but if I look at my definition for the average voltage on the inductor, it's just the 1 over TS times this same integral, and since it's equal to zero, I can multiply through both sides by TS and get the same thing. So this is effectively saying the average voltage on my inductor is equal to zero in steady state. Okay. Make sense? Okay, so see if we can rederive our conversion ratio a bit more quickly using more of a direct application of volt second balance. Okay, what volt second balance tells me is that average voltage on my inductor is equal to zero. So I can look at in my two switching positions, what is the voltage on the inductor? Here it's VGE minus V. already applying my small ripple approximation. This would be V of T. Small ripple tells me I can approximate that as just the DC component. Same thing over here. Voltage on my inductor is just minus V. So I'm in switch position one for DTS amount of time, switch position two for D prime TS amount of time. Then my average voltage is going to be 1 over TS times the time of switch position one times its voltage plus same thing for switch position two. My TSs are going to cancel out. So I multiply through. Let's say zero is equal to now D VG minus V plus D prime minus V. And then I again group terms by my voltages. My VG term, I'm just going to have DVG, and then I'm going to have plus V plus D prime times minus V. This thing is equal to 1. And 0 is equal to DVG minus V, or M is equal to V over VG is equal to D for the buck converter. Okay. A little bit quicker than having to do the delta ILs on everything, but gets me to the same point, is equivalent. Functionally, I'm doing the same thing. A couple more steps that can quicken up your analysis. I recommend kind of first couple problems on the homework going through completely. As you develop intuition on this, hey, these TSs are always going to cancel out. I'm always going to have a 1 over TS times an average where all of my duty cycles are multiplied by TS. So I don't have to bother writing those. Also, you're going to see this come up a lot, this D plus D prime term, where that's going to go to 1. You can see that in my circuits here, I have minus V here and minus V here. It means my voltage has this minus V component always, whether I'm in position 1 or position 2. So I know this minus V term is going to show up here without any duty cycle multiplier, whereas VG is only in the first subinterval. I know it's going to have a D multiplier. Okay. I compare my two expressions. Anything that's common between them is going to have no duty cycle multiplier because that voltage is always present on the inductor. Okay. Questions on volt-second balance? Volt-second balance is balancing volt seconds. It's going to give us an equation which in general gives us some information about the voltages in the converter that we didn't have at the beginning. So in this buck converter, there's only one unknown voltage that I'm interested in. That's the output voltage. Volt second balance gives it to me. It tells me what the output voltage is in this converter. All right. Okay. While we're kind of on this topic, one other thing I want to look at that we're sometimes interested in solving is what is the ripple magnitude on these converters. Okay. This is one area where we're going to obviously kind of relax the small ripple approximation. So when I first talked about small ripple approximation, I said, okay, currents and inductors, I can approximate that they're just the average value and have no ripple. That approximation works well when I want to solve output voltage or input current or something else, but I might want to know what the ripple is on the inductor current. And obviously I have to relax the small ripple approximation on the inductor to get any useful information about that. Otherwise it just tell me it's always zero. But this is something I need to design as part of my converter. I might want to say, okay, my current ripple is less than 10% of the average value. How do I select the way the converter operates and is implemented physically in order to achieve that? Okay. So I'm going to go back and I'm going to relax many of my small ripple approximations as is necessary. Here, all that's going to be necessary is, okay, I allow current ripple to exist on the inductor. So I take my inductor current plot, just as we drew it before, where I've got this VG minus V over L, or VG minus V over L slope minus V over L slope. And from this, I can directly derive what the inductor current is. Actually, already done this, we're just going to formalize it here. This is why I promised I'd give justification for it earlier, but why when we were back here I called this 2 delta IL if we were deriving is because delta IL is the current ripple defined, and it's the peak to average current ripple the way we define it, not the peak to peak as I wanted here. Okay. Looking at this parameter delta IL that we want to solve. See, it's the difference between the average value, capital I, and then the peak or minimum. Okay. Delta IL is peak to average current ripple. Okay, so nonetheless, we can derive this in the same way. If I know the slope and I know the time, I know the total change over one interval, and that's going to be 2 delta IL because the total change over this interval goes from minimum to maximum, not peak to average. So solve this 2 delta IL is going to be equal to, here I can actually pick either interval. Say it's the slope times the time in this interval or this interval, I'll get equivalent expressions. I'll just pick the first interval for simplicity, VG minus V over L times DTS. So then my delta IL, VG minus V over 2L times DTS. Maybe that's good enough for me at that point. I could also plug in from my conversion ratio here. I can eliminate, for example, the output voltage from this expression, replacing it with D times VG. So from that, I know that V is equal to dVG, plug that in, what I'm gonna get is delta IL equal to VG minus dVG over 2L times DTS, or VG times 1 minus D over 2L times DTS. 1 minus D, we have a name for that, D prime. All right. B, DG over 2L, D, D prime, TS. Okay. Some quick intuition on this. In general, this ripple is something, a quantity to be minimized. Nothing good is coming from it. We'd like this to be, you know, well approximated by the small ripple approximation. So I probably want delta IL to remain fairly small. So to decrease delta IL in a given application, what can I do from the design standpoint? Well, in some application, my input voltage is probably fixed, and then my duty cycle has to be set to give me the output voltage I want. We'll say, okay, I need a 12-to-1 converter, or you know, 12-to-1 converter, so I know what D is from D is equal to DVG to give me that output voltage. VG, my input's fixed. So I have left, I have TS and L that I can play with as knobs as a designer. I can change around to affect this current ripple. So if I want to decrease it, I can do that by either increasing L because it's in the denominator or decreasing TS in the numerator. I can increase L or decrease TS, which is the same thing as increasing my switching frequency. Okay. Bigger inductor, bigger switching frequency. Okay. Power electronics, as any design problem, there is no free lunch. So bigger inductor is potentially meaning a bigger physical element, which could be more costly, and that size could be a problem for implementing this converter. I'm kind of constrained in space. I can also create that by, on some given magnetic core, I wrap more turns. If I wrap more turns, I have more resistance to the inductor. It's going to hurt my efficiency, producing more losses. Increasing switching frequency. I've talked about this ideal switch, but when we actually implement this with real devices, there's some energy loss every time I try to switch a MOSFET, time I turn on and off a diode. Those energy losses are going to be proportional to switching frequency, so if I switch faster, my switching losses are going to be more of a problem, my efficiency is going to be hurt by it. Okay? So neither of these come free. We'll get more into analysis of efficiency and different losses a little later. And then as far as inductor design and how that plays out in realizing the physical components, that's really the last few weeks of the course we get into physical inductor design. For now, just analytically, put whatever you want, but these are ways to decrease the inductor current. Okay. Questions there? Okay, if not, we've got one more tool to develop. And so it's known as capacitor charge balance. And we're going to kind of derive it and quickly apply it to the buck converter here. So cap charge balance is the dual of volt second balance. And it's going to follow exactly the same principles. Volt second balance, I said, inductor current at the beginning and end of the interval has to be the same for me to be in steady state. Cap charge balance, okay, with my capacitors, their voltage has to be the beginning, the same at the beginning and end of the interval in order to be in steady state. Okay. Maybe we'll just hop down here. Very similar slides. Basically, same thing I did for volt second balance, but I just swap all currents with voltages and all inductors with caps, and I get the dual relationship. Okay. So this is my capacitor relationship. If I integrate over that, I get the difference in the capacitor voltage between the beginning and end of the interval is equal to the integral of the current that goes through the capacitor. If I want voltages beginning and end to be in the same, so that I'm sitting in steady state, zero is equal to the integral of the current through the cap, which is equal to average current of the cap over one switching period. So volt second balance said average voltage on my inductors is zero. Cap charge balance says average current in my capacitors is zero over one switching period. Recall that these angle brackets mean average, and there's an implied over one switching period here. Won't work if I average over some arbitrary amount of time, but over one switching period where I'm periodic, that's where I can reach steady state. So I come back here to the buck and I want to apply cap charge balance. I'm going to use the same approach. I'm going to split this up and analyze the equivalent circuit when the switch is in position one and when the switch is in position two. Okay, so when the switch is in position one, shorted across, I want to know what the current in the capacitor is. Do a KCL at this node here. Capacitor current I sub C is inductor current minus this current, call it I sub R. I don't, in general, know what that is. I can't just write I sub R, but I know the capacitor voltage is something I can apply small ripple approximation to, and I know I sub R is V over R. I'm going to write this as capacitor current in this subinterval 1 is equal to inductor current minus capacitor voltage over load resistance. Okay. So when I'm writing these expressions, we'll elaborate on that a little bit. What I want in here is things that I'm going to be able to take to DC average values, right? So I could do something like just put I sub R in this equation. But I sub R, I don't know anything about. I don't have any small ripple approximation on resistor current. What I know are independent inputs like VG. And then I know by small ripple approximation, I have DC values for inductor currents and capacitor voltages. So in both volt second balance and cap charge balance, if I go through and write these equations, I want to get them in terms of those things, my inputs and my states, cap voltages and inductor currents and inputs. Okay. So I write it in this expression so that when I apply my small ripple approximation, what I'm going to get is the capacitor current is IL minus V over R, where both of these time-varying things that were included are things that I can apply small ripple to get DC values. Okay. That's subinterval 1. When I switch down this way, I go to subinterval 2. Now my circuit has changed, but not at the node I'm looking at where I've been applying my KCL, right? Doesn't matter that things changed back here. Capacitor current is still inductor current minus load current. So my equation actually doesn't change at all. I sub C of T is equal to IL of T minus V of T over R. Apply the same small ripple approximation. I sub C of T equal to IL minus V over R. I actually have no difference between the two subintervals. So now when I apply cap charge balance, I'm going to bring these two things together. Say that the average current in the capacitor is equal to zero. Do one more, doing out all the steps here. So this average current is going to be 1 over Ts times the integral of the capacitor current with respect to time from 0 to Ts. This integral then is going to evaluate to constant value times the time that I'm in switch position one plus constant value times the time that I'm in switch position two. It'll look like DTS times this, IL minus V over R plus D prime TS times this IL minus V over R TS's will cancel. I'll get 0 is equal to D plus D prime times IL minus V over R. This term goes to 1. And I'm going to get IL is equal to V over R. So this is a special case where the switching didn't affect my expressions at all. This answer doesn't make sense. Well, yeah, that node didn't change. If there's zero average current in the capacitor, then all of the average current from the inductor has to go through the load. So this tells me at DC, my average inductor current is my average load current. None of that average current can go through the capacitor. Ripple still does. I am including it, but by applying the small ripple approximation and getting rid of that, all the inductor current just goes straight to the load. Okay. All right. So we've now solved the buck converter. Okay. Volt second balance gave us an expression for the output voltage. Cap charge balance gave us an expression for the inductor current. Kind of linked, and that volt second balance on the inductor told us the voltage on the capacitor. Cap charge balance on the capacitor told us current in the inductor. Okay. But with those two, we solved out, manipulate these equations. We know what average values are and everything for any given operating point. Questions on these techniques or on buck converter operation? Okay, if not, we're going to do another example. This time we're going to move on to the boost converter, which is shown here. The top, our ideal implementation with a single pole dual throw switch. Down here, what it looks like when you implement it, kind of the most simple form with real semiconductor elements. How I knew that this single pole dual throw switch became these two elements is something we cover in chapter 4. How to figure out, can this thing be a MOSFET and a diode, or two MOSFETs, or four diodes, or how do I implement that? Okay. Boost converter, in some sense, really just looks like a backwards buck converter. My capacitor was instead here. Then this thing, my input over here, would just look like a buck converter drawn right to left instead of left to right. In any kind of practical implementation, that's actually true. Boost converter is just a buck converter with power going the other direction, because I always need this capacitor in any practical implementation. Okay. It does absolutely nothing for me on hand analysis, because it's in parallel with a voltage source. So the voltage on the cap is always VG, and there's never any current in it. There's no point in including it in my hand analysis. If I actually go to build a real converter, I always need good caps on any voltage that I'm calling DC. So this voltage source is some physical voltage source that may be far away, and then I've got some wires that have parasitics and pick up noise coming to connect to my converter. I need a good cap right at the input that's going to hold a DC voltage for me. Decouple this thing from external noise. Same thing with the buck converter. I need a good cap at the input there too. So really kind of just a backward buck converter. But because this does nothing in our equations, now I've got the switch in the middle of my two passive elements, and the analysis and equations are going to be a little bit different. Okay. So if I want to analyze this thing, I'm going to apply kind of the same algorithm we've been using. I'm going to break it apart into my subinterval 1 and subinterval 2 based on the switch positions. I'm going to look at inductor voltages and capacitor currents. I'm going to apply small ripple approximation, volt second balance, cap charge balance, look at the resulting equation. Okay. So break this thing up into these two equivalent circuits, subinterval 1 and 2, based on the switch position. The next two slides, I've got these two equivalent circuits individually. We'll write all the equations for each. Okay, so in subinterval 1, my equivalent circuit, I want to write expressions for my inductor voltage, capacitor current, so that I can average them later. My inductor voltage here, on the polarity I've shown, is just Vg. My capacitor current, polarity drawn going down into the capacitor, so it matches up with the polarity of V. So my capacitor current is going to be minus V over R. Apply my small ripple approximation to both of these expressions. V sub L doesn't change. Already got the input, and that is DC, no approximation needed. I sub C does change. The output voltage is a capacitor voltage. I can approximate that by its DC component. Okay. Subinterval 2, switch commutates. I get a slightly different circuit. I'm going to write these same two things. Voltage on the inductor, current in the capacitor. Case inductor voltage is going to be Vg minus Vt. Faster current, I of t minus V of t over R. Small ripple approximation, V of t is Vg minus V, capacitor voltage. IC of t is IL, inductor current, minus B, capacitor voltage over R. All three of these, small ripple approximation applies. Okay. Now I've looked at it in both subintervals. I'm going to bring those things together and plot them on a pair of axes here for this boost converter. So I've got subinterval 1 and 2. Subinterval 1, my inductor voltage was Vg, subinterval 2 is Vg minus V. Capacitor currents were what? Minus V over R and IL minus V over R. Okay, so if I want to plot these, how do I know where they are? Well, I'll start here and I'm going to say some arbitrary positive value for Vg. It's a fair assumption to make that if I drew my input like this, Vg is greater than zero. Vg is something known, it's the input. You can assume that, okay, I didn't try to mess with you, and Vg is actually minus 2 volts. If I draw it like this, it's a positive voltage greater than zero. What you won't know in general, if I put the voltage here, is that positive or negative? Depends on the operation of the converter. Okay, this thing's some input, but the output depends on the operation of the converter. Okay, so if I don't think too much about the name of this converter, how do I know whether Vg minus V, I should draw it, you know, up here or here, same value, something here? Where should this be? Below it, somewhere here. by a negative. So the easy answer is, last lecture you said it's a boost converter and the output's greater than the input, okay? Let's assume I call this the Watkins-Johnson converter. Okay, how do you know? Well, you know because you know volt-second balance is going to have to apply. So the average of this voltage waveform has to be zero. If I've got some positive value here, if I integrate this up, I get some area, A1, I need an equal negative area to cancel that out so that my average can be zero. So it has to be somewhere down here so that this volt second balance can hold true. These areas are equal and my average is zero. Okay. So even if I didn't know just from it being a boost converter, I now know that V is some positive value greater than VG to make this possible. So then when I come down here, V is some positive value, fairly large. That means this is negative. And then that means IL minus V over R has to be positive so that I can get my cap charge balance. Okay. And my drawing skills aren't expert, but I made BTS, V is a little bit less than a half, this interval shorter. I know that kind of VG has to be taller than this VG minus V is negative, so that these areas will cancel. Right? I tried to draw that. Maybe not great. Okay. So we have these things, got our volts on the inductor, our current in the capacitors. I can now with these expressions average them, set them to zero, and I'll derive equations about the converter. Just quickly while we're on these axes. So what do kind of the duals of both of these look like? The inductor current and capacitor voltage. The inductor current, the voltage is constant. It's going to have a slope that looks like this, increasing during this interval, decreasing a little bit more shallow during this interval so that start and end values are the same. The slope can be a little steeper in the first one, a little more shallow in the second one because the times are different. The capacitor voltage is going to look like the opposite. For both of these, they're going to be centered around this average value, in this case, IL, in this case, V, this is IL of T, this is V of T, and you'll forgive, I'm on different y-axes, right? Purple is related to a current axis. Red is related to a voltage axis, the opposite up above. That's going to be generally the form of these, the slopes, VG over L, VG minus V over L, minus V over RC, IL minus V over R, whole thing over C, the slopes of these waveforms, okay? We know the slopes to get the actual average values, V and IL. That's what we're going to get out of volt second and cap charge balance. So if I apply those volt second balance, those mean that the average voltage on the inductor is zero. I'm going to now plug in and solve my expression for that. Go a little bit faster this time. I've got a VG term in both intervals. I'm going to have VG show up without any duty cycle multiplier. Then I have minus V only in the second interval. So it's going to have a D prime multiplier. What we get is VG minus D prime V. The average voltage on my inductor. That's equal to zero. So I can solve this. z is equal to vg over d prime, or m v over vg, 1 over d prime. Gap charge balance, average current in my capacitor is 0. Same process, my expressions here. Got this minus V over R, that's constant. And then an IL that only shows up in the D prime interval. So what I'll get is D prime IL minus V over R. This is gonna tell me my inductor current is V over R D prime. By applying these, I figure out the expression for my average inductive current, one for my capacitor voltage. Now, as I go back, I can completely define these waveforms. I know how to solve the ripple. I know how to solve the average value of both. I've completely solved the converter. I know everything that's going on in it. Okay. I'm doing on time. We got time. Okay. So looking at this conversion ratio, M is 1 over D prime. What we get is something that looks like this. So here I'm plotting M of D. This is that conversion ratio, V over VG, versus the duty cycle itself. Expression is 1 over D prime, so I'm plotting 1 over 1 minus D with respect to D. As expected, that's something that starts at 1. My duty cycle is 0, my output voltage is equal to my input voltage, and then as the duty cycle increases, this thing ramps off. Looking at the expression, if D goes to 1, it is 1 over 1 minus 1, this thing explodes towards infinity. As D approaches 1, V approaches infinity. And it's undefined at D is equal to 1. What do we think about that? So I can take this converter, give it 1 volt input, set D to 0.99999, and get a gigavolt at the output. So there's probably a realistic cutoff. Absolutely. Duty cycle, in general, I can put anyone on this thing, right? I can develop something that says switch at 0.999. I got a high enough resolution DSP to generate that quick pulse. I can tell it to do it. So duty cycle itself is not fundamentally limited, but the converter behavior is going to be. Okay? So we can look at that. We can look at the extreme values here. So if I look at D is equal to 0, so I think it'll actually give me 1 volt output. So here, D is equal to 0, or not, excuse me, 1 volt, a conversion ratio of 1, my output equal to my input. So that just means that the switch is always in switch position 2. If I short across, what do I get? Well, this thing's just a fixed LC filter now, right? So I'm going to get an equivalent circuit that looks like VG, L, C, R. And conversion ratio of that is 1. LC filter, the average here is going to be equal to VG. That works. C is equal to 1. My switch is in the other position. In a circuit that looks like this. I'll just fix now, I'm not switching. Switch is always in this position. I apply a constant voltage to my inductor and my load is completely disconnected. It's gonna happen, this inductor current's just gonna run away to infinity and I'm never gonna supply any power to the output, completely disconnected, okay? So, is equal to 1, I can apply this, but my converter will blow up. Current's just going to run away unbounded, right? So this is my ideal conversion ratio. Real systems, we don't have discontinuity, so it's not going to approach infinity and then explode. It's going to gradually deteriorate in operation. So any kind of real converter would have some conversion ratio that looks something more like this. Where this gets into kind of the next couple chapters, but when we actually look at losses in this thing, even as I approach this, even as my duty cycle is very high but less than 1, I'm going to get very high peak current stresses on my inductor for very little output power. If I have any kind of resistance anywhere in this circuit, that's going to mean I have a whole lot of losses and I'm not delivering a lot of power, so my efficiency is going to tank and the voltage is going to drop because I'm not delivering enough power to keep it up. So my real conversion ratio, it'll tank at some point. Practically, depending on how good a job you've done of designing this thing, you may be able to get conversion ratios close to 10 in that range, but anything above that, the boost converter is going to start to fall apart. Okay. So we'll get into that and actually derive the shape of this curve with some real loss mechanisms in a few lectures. Okay. So next time, we're going to move on. We're going to talk about a little bit more complex of a converter, Chuck converter. Now got 2 inductors, 2 capacitors, a little bit more involved, but we're going to use the same principles to analyze this thing. Pick up there on Wednesday.